Joining me now for a return visit to Fresh Air is jazz cellist and composer David Aegis. For the past year or more, he's been playing with Philadelphia-based saxophonist Byard Lancaster. They recorded a duet album called The Arrow. This duo has somehow become a trio recently with the addition of another Philadelphia-based musician, drummer Sonny Murray. This trio has just completed their first album together, which we'll be hearing some selections from in just a few minutes. It's called Crossroads, and it's produced on David Aegis' independent label called Music Unlimited. David Aegis studied cello at the Manhattan School of Music, and he's one of the few jazz musicians whose first instrument is the cello. Consequently, his playing and composing is helping to state the possibilities of that instrument in a contemporary jazz setting. David, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's good to be here, Terry.
You've added a drummer to the duo that you've been composed with yourself and Byard Lancaster. Why did you want a drummer added to that music?
Well, there was a certain kind of music that I wanted to play that had more rhythm, and also what really happened is that due to a variety of circumstances, Byard and I teamed up, and we are a duo, and we've done a number of performances over the past several years, for the past 3 or 4 years. And recently I added Sonny because I was hearing more percussive kind of sound in my mind, and what had happened really was that while I was playing with the duet, my own playing was getting more percussively oriented. And I think what was really happening was I was kind of getting ready to work with Sonny and to have Sonny work with me in my own group. And this, I think, is something that I'd like to continue to do. The new record with the trio of Byard, Sonny, and myself features all my own compositions, as did the Arrow recording with the duet. And, of course, I'd like to mention that the duet is the first jazz ensemble in the country to receive a grant from Chamber Music America, and this is something that's been happening in a lot of the musics lately. I think that a lot of musicians have been sort of crossing the line between jazz and classical music, and a lot of people who are trained in jazz are playing classical music, and a lot of people who are trained classically, like myself, are playing jazz. And I think this is something that's, you know, very important, and I think it's opening up a lot of boundaries and for the music and musicians, and creating a lot of different things happening, which is making a lot of very exciting things happening. And of course, we're very pleased to have been part of this expansion in the music.
Well, your playing can go in lots of different directions because you're classically trained. You can play classical music most of the time. I think you choose to play jazz, but on the new album, as we'll hear, you've added a lot of funk rhythms and lines in it, and it's a kind of extension of things that you've implied before but never stated in the way you do on this album. Is funk a part of your listening background, David?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I've just recently been listening to Otis Redding, and I've particularly been listening to the Memphis horns behind him, the close-set harmonies that they have, and also, I think I've drawn some of my influences, the way I'm playing the cello, particularly in this new recording, from people like Larry Graham, the Sly and Family Stone, and people like that. So this is something that I've always, you know, been aware of. And, of course, I played the blues guitar when I was a teenager, and I've translated this style onto the cello. And so this is something that's, you know, part of my style.
Well, before we talk some more about the music that you're playing, let's listen to some of it.
Okay.
This is from the new David Aegis album, Crossroads. We'll be hearing the title selection from it. It's called Crossroads. Again, we have Byard Lancaster on alto saxophone, Sonny Murray on drums. Do you want to say anything specifically about this piece before we hear it?
Well, Crossroads was named after a song I heard on a record called King of the Delta Blues Singers by Robert Johnson, which was on Columbia. It was a remarkable album. Is actually the only full album that Robert Johnson ever recorded, and I heard that when I was quite young and playing the blues guitar when I was 14 or 15, and the record made a big impression on me. And so since this tune is kind of a blues, I thought I'd name it after that tune from Robert Johnson. So this is called Crossroads, and that's why I named it like that.
Okay, let's hear it.
Thank you.
Crosswords, and we heard a trio comprised of my guest cellist and composer David Aegis on cello, Byard Lancaster on alto, and Sonny Murray on drums. And both Byard and Sonny Murray are Philadelphia-based musicians, although they actually spend a lot of time traveling around the world and playing. David, would you call that fusion? Is fusion an appropriate term? Because you're combining a few different musical languages in it, but it's not really, I think, what we think of when we think of fusion.
Well, I don't think it's the music that's labeled fusion per se, and which I'm glad it isn't, because I think most fusion is not really a successful musical. I think the beginnings of the fusion was very successful, particularly what Miles put out and things like Bitches Brew and things like that. But I think this is maybe a new kind of fusion, if you want to call it that, a fusion of blues and, you know, little rock and, of course, the jazz-based idiom. So it could call it fusion, but I think to call it fusion would be mistaking a label for it now. I don't think it would be the proper label for it, because we already have a label for fusion, which is something different, a different kind of music.
What did you want to get into this? Because let me put it this way. Some people that hear a funk line and something, they say, ah, boy, he's really trying to sell out, trying to make it really big. And there's a number of jazz musicians who are incorporating like rhythm and blues and rock lines in it in a way that hasn't been done before.
Mm-hmm.
What musically started to interest you now in adding this to your composition?
Well, I've always played the blues, and I think it's more apparent now, particularly now that I have a drummer working with me, and of course such a fine drummer as Sonny. But I think that something like the tune Sweetness is Beauty from the Arrow album was also very blues-based, and there were blues-based things on my first record, too, called The Captain. In fact, The Captain was quite blues-based. And I've always felt the blues very strongly, and of course I've always been interested in the blues as a form, and I don't think the blues has to be 12 or 16 bars, it can be 11. It's a very flexible form. I don't think people know that. I think people think of blues as a very set form, which it can be very fine in that form where you have the 12 or 16 bar and the, you know, the verses and the phrases and all that. But I think it's something can also be done with it, which, you know, I think I'm one of the people who's, you know, sort of transfusing the blues in a certain sense. And I think that's what I'm doing on this record, and I think it just happens to be more apparent. And of course, another reason for my putting something like that on the record is that I would like to introduce people to other parts of my music which may not be quite as accessible, but I think are just as valuable. But I do want people, of course, to listen, and if people can't, you know, really hear something right away, then they sometimes don't want to explore further. And I think that it's very important to give something that people can really, you know, catch on with very simply, and then they're more willing to experiment with perhaps the more advanced kind of things.
What did you talk with Sonny Murray about the first few times that you played with him? When you're writing a composition, you don't really write in the percussion line, I imagine. You don't write in the drum part. Did you talk with him about what you were trying to achieve in your new pieces?
Well, Sonny and I had a really remarkable empathy. We didn't really have to talk a great deal. I did have, of course, you know, some basic parts written, but Byard has worked with Sonny for many years, and so they had already had a very good rapport. So I was really sort of stepping into a very easy situation in the sense that two people had already known each other very well musically. There were sort of two sets of two, in other words, Byard and Sonny and Byard and me, and so Byard, in the sense, was the link between us. And but we didn't even really have to have a link. I think Sonny and I just really understood where each other were coming from right away. And we had extensive rehearsals for this recording, which, by the way, is a recording in concert. So when we do perform in the era, you'll be hearing something, you know, quite similar to this recording. There are no overdubs, no anything, just the music that was recorded in Boston on November 19th, 1981.
Let's hear another selection from the album. And
okay.
This is a piece that I think is an interesting contrast to the first piece that we heard. We're going to be hearing Nothing Has Changed, Yet Everything Has Changed. Do you want to say a few words about what you've done here?
Sure. Well, it starts with a flute and cello line, and then Byard switches to soprano, saxophone, and then there's a counterpoint between the alto, saxophone, and cello. Byard again switches, and it's the same theme for different instruments, so it is the same line, but it's different timbres. And Then it continues, and Bayard plays both horns at once during the middle of the piece, both alto and soprano sax. And then it goes out with Bayard playing the same line that you heard in the beginning on piccolo, and that's why it's called Nothing Has Changed, Yet Everything Has Changed, because it comes like a full circle. It really has to do with, you know, there's so many things that in life that you go back to a certain place, and that place might be physically the same, but you've changed, or that place might not be the same anymore, and it's like something's changed, but nothing's changed, and it's that kind of philosophy or something in life that, you know, everybody, I think, runs into, where they've encountered changes within themselves or changes, you know, in their environment, but still something remains the same.
Okay, well, let's hear it. Again, we'll be hearing David Egis on cello, Bayard Lancaster on a number of saxophones and flute, and Sonny Murray on drums. From the new David Aegis album, Crossroads, we've heard Nothing Has Changed, Everything Has Changed. And it again featured David on cello, Bard Lancaster on alto, soprano, and flute, and Sonny Murray on drums. And the new album is on David's own music label, which is called Music Unlimited. On most of the selections on this, the solos are pretty short. We all remember the days when solos were 15 to 20 minutes long. Have you consciously been working with shorter solos in your pieces and a heavier emphasis on composition?
Well, composition has always been, you know, my primary thrust, although I think that many people have seen me as the cellist that plays jazz and that focused on that part of my music, but I always have felt that the concept of the compositions is the most important thing that I've been doing, and that the cello is just the available instrument that I have, and I think it's a very good instrument for what I'm doing, too. As far as the length of things, I personally believe that records should be programmed so that they're really listenable to a wide variety of people, and I think that these pieces or compositions that we've done are consciously on the shorter side, although we do longer things as well. But as I said before, this record was recorded in concert, and so we do play like this in concert, and we don't play like this on record and then go and play 20-minute solos. I think that if you really have something to say, I mean, that you can say it within a reasonably short period of time, although, you know, there are instances where we do extend ourselves, but I think in this event, particularly where I have so many compositions that I would like to be recorded, and I'm producing and programming the records myself, I do tend to lean towards the shorter takes.
Could you see yourself writing for other people and just sitting out completely?
Oh, yes, very much so. I'd like to do that. As a matter of fact, we were recently at Harvard University, that is Bayard and myself, and we did a performance and lecture there, and the director of the Harvard band there, Tom Everett, invited me to write for his big band, which I think would be very interesting for me to do. I haven't done it yet, but I think it's something I'd certainly like to look into, and I'd like to probably study arranging and composition. I've never studied composition formally, so I think it would be something very interesting for me to explore.
You know, some people say that if you're a natural at your instrument, that sometimes, or even if it's singing, that sometimes studying can take away some of your more intuitive qualities. Is that kind of thing possibly true with composition?
I don't really think so. I think if you have the talent or gift for composition, that I think it's only something that can be refined and extended and deepened if you study. I think that's true of, you know, any artistic endeavor. And I do think that there are just certain kind of things that are done spontaneously. I don't know quite how somebody would study to play the cello like I've developed a style, although I did, you know, study various things myself, but I think the fact that I found them myself was very important, and the fact that I discovered, you know, that practicing Charlie Parker lines in the cello was very valuable, and various other things that I've done in my cello studies and also translating the blues guitar playing onto the cello, I think all those things have, you know, made my style what it is, but I don't know quite how I would tell somebody else to do that.
I see your point. Yeah. I guess your style evolves from, like, knowing the instrument inside out and then stretching it and playing with it and seeing what can be done that no one's ever mentioned before, that no one's figured out yet.
Yes, that's true, and I think a lot of it is drawn from the wide variety of music listening that I do, that I've listened to contemporary classical, to the blues, to people like Ornette and Charles Mingus, and, you know, also people like Otis Redding and Jimi Hendrix. So, I mean, I think, you know, you put all that into playing the cello, and it's going to obviously come out in a fairly unique way, which I think it is, and I think that's an important part of my style, is that the fact that I've incorporated so many different listenings into the way I play and also compose, I think the listening has helped me a great deal.
This album, as you've mentioned, was recorded at a concert in New York.
In Boston.
Oh, in Boston.
That fact.
Is there more of a spirited feel with people out there in the audience as you're recording? Do you get more adrenaline pumping or anything like that?
Well, there are a number of reasons for me to record live. One is just basically economics, but also I had the benefit of excellent engineer, Dave Baker, and also some very fine equipment, which was also used to record my previous album, Arrow, and the person who runs that studio and owns the equipment is a friend of mine, so we had worked out an arrangement where we could record the concert. I think there are a lot of advantages to recording live for this kind of music. I mean, there aren't any overdubs necessary. I think that the audience does have a kind of feedback, and I think, you know, generally it's really can be a very good way to record. I think, you know, you get that kind of spontaneity, which is so important to the music, which you might not get in the studio, particularly since this group, the trio, had not done a lot of concerts before. So I think it was, you know, good to just go out and hit it once. I think if a group's been around a long time, then it's easier to go either way in the studio or in concert recording.
Just wondering, like many musicians, you're producing and distributing your music yourself. What's your approach to getting your music heard, either through radio stations or getting it placed in stores? Do you travel around doing that yourself? Or?
Well, I do some of it myself. New Music Distribution handles it, and Rick Ballard on the coast handles it. And of course, I do service some of the stores myself, people that I know, like people at Third Street Jazz and Igor Records in New York, people like that. But I think there's many advantages to producing your own work. I mean, you own it and you can use it however you want. You can send it to the radio stations. It's not that difficult to get a good radio list. And you have them on hand, you know, you can use them to get a grant. I think our duo recording, The Arrow, was very essential to our receiving the grant from Chamber Music America, which I mentioned before. And so there are merely many advantages to producing your own work. I had received a couple offers from a couple of smaller labels, and I just didn't feel that they were commensurate with what I was doing, so I'm glad that I've been able to get these records out on my own.
Well, you've mentioned the Chamber Music America grant, and that grant is going to be enabling David Aegis and Byard Lancaster to do a residency in Philadelphia, and they'll be a joint residency with the Painted Bright Arts Center and with WUHY. So we're looking forward to, in the fall, doing a number of concerts in Philadelphia. There'll be a concert here at WUHY and a workshop one afternoon on Fresh Air, in which Byard and David will not only perform, but will also discuss their the compositional and improvisational process, and they'll really describe both in words and music what it is they do together and how they play together. And I'm certainly looking forward to working with you on that, David.
Well, Terry, I think it would be a pleasure.
And then we'll be doing that sometime in late October, so if you want to keep your ears open for it. Well, good luck to you, and good luck with your new record. And I've enjoyed it and enjoyed having you back on Fresh Air.
Well, thanks, Terry. It's really been a pleasure being here.
We're going to hear one final selection. This is called Loquacity, and it's the Loquacity, Loquacity. And it doesn't sound right, does it? It's the last selection on the album. Do you want to say a couple of words?
Well, yes. This was written for Sonny Murray, because Sonny is a very loquacious person. And it features a short solo by Sonny. And then basically what happens is there's three different times going. It's like three different wheels turning at different speeds, but they all fit together. The cello is the slowest, the alto saxophone is the fastest, and Sonny's in the middle.
Okay, let's hear it from the album Crossroads, David Aegis, Byard Lancaster, and Sonny Murray.
Thank you.
Bo Cassidy from David Aegis's new album Crossroads, which is on his own record label called Music Unlimited. Again, we heard from David Aegis, Byard Lancaster, and Sonny Murray. It's 18 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on 91 FM. At 3:30, John Swed will be with us for this week's edition of The Record Show. He'll be featuring recordings by Cal Jader, who died just a few weeks ago. At 4 o'clock, I'll be speaking with Kate Simon. She's a travel writer who's the author of a new book that's an autobiography of her childhood growing up in the South Bronx in the 1920s in a neighborhood composed of immigrant families. The book is called Bronx Primitive. In about 15 minutes, we'll be hearing a documentary from the NPR Journal series about Egypt and about conflicts there between modern and traditional values. It was recorded by William Drummond and Deborah Amos, who were recently on assignment in the Middle East. Joan Kerr was one of the leading Philadelphia-based choreographers and teachers until her death earlier this year of a brain tumor. She was 47. This weekend, several Philadelphia dancers will present a tribute to Joan Kerr at the Painted Bride Art Center. One of the performers and organizers of this tribute is choreographer and dancer Terry Fox. Terry first met Joan Kerr in 1965 at Temple University. She studied with her for 2 years, and then Kerr invited Fox to perform with her company in 1972. And then in 1980, she asked Terry Fox to dance with her in a piece that she had dedicated to a recently deceased friend. I spoke with Terry Fox earlier this week and asked her to share some of her memories of Joan Kerr. She began by discussing Kerr's contributions to the Philadelphia dance community.
She struggled in her own studio. She wasn't aligned with any particular kind of university or academic style. She was an artist in the old sense. That was one of the things that she gave, just an approach to a dancer as an artist. And the other thing is that she was very good at teaching Horton technique, which is a kind of obscure technique because Lester Horton died in the 50s, and Alvin Ailey, I guess, is most famous proponent to sort of carry it on. And there's some other teachers around. Bella Lewitsky was also on the West Coast. It was not too known here on the East Coast. So Joan continued that technique, which is a very good one, a very strong technique, classical, modern, you know, late 40s, 1950s. And she taught that to many young students as well as, you know, aspiring dancers. So I would say those things were the two most important aspects of her legacy as an artist and a dancer, choreographer. Her work was interesting, too. She carried on the tradition of choreodramas, which was also a Horton tradition. And I think that was difficult for a lot of young dancers that are coming along now to relate to. But she had a sense of